Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. These are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Ashley Thompson and Dan Friedel talk about enrollment at United States community colleges. John Russell brings us a science story on black holes. I will return with words and their stories. This week, I talk about a common expression that comes from animals. We will finish our program with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. And now, the education report.
Community colleges offer two-year degrees and job training. They often appeal to older students looking to learn new skills. Phoenix College is one of many community colleges in America to have seen major drops in enrollment over the last year as students face difficulties with money, family life, and online learning. Across the country, community colleges have seen a 10% drop from the autumn of 2019 to autumn 2020. Those numbers come from the National Student Clearinghouse. Community colleges have been hit harder than four-year colleges and universities. The pandemic has had a severe effect on older adult students who choose the community college path. Many have lost jobs or have no time for their own schooling as they supervise their children's online classes.
Martha Parham is Senior Vice President for the American Association of Community Colleges. She noted that the majority of older adult community college students have or had jobs in industries that have been badly hurt by the pandemic. Often during times of nationwide economic difficulties, more Americans turn to community college education. They do so to learn new job skills or change their careers. But that has not happened during the pandemic, education experts say. That raises concerns for policymakers and others who consider community colleges to be an important path for low-earning Americans. At a Senate hearing last month, Miguel Cardona, President Joe Biden's pick for education secretary, called for federal financial support to help hurting community colleges.
Even in good economic times, many community college students struggle to stay in school as they deal with the demands of supporting families, paying for housing, and covering the costs of school.
Across the U.S., community colleges have reported rising demand from students who need help getting food. At Mass Bay Community College near Boston, applications for meal assistance have increased 80% since last year. Denora Torres, a single mother with four young daughters, said the assistance helped her continue taking classes. "If I didn't have that, I don't know if I could have been able to make it," said Torres, who is 29. "It has been really hard. A lot of nights I'm not sleeping. Some days I would have to send my kids to my parents so I could work all day on catching up." Mass Bay suffered a 10% drop in enrollment. School officials there have been giving increasing financial aid for students. Torres said donors set up by the college brought her family a Thanksgiving meal and Christmas presents for her daughters. "They got my daughters each a gift," Torres said. "I wasn't even going to celebrate the holidays this year because I didn't have the money."
Community college supporters hope the enrollment drop is temporary. Some experts predict many students will return to classes when schools reopen and jobs return. But at least some students are expected to decide against higher education. Experts say that choice could lead to a lifetime of lower earnings and financial struggles. "We are worried about losing some of them permanently," said David Podell, president of MassBay. "They may follow up later, but each year that they defer their education, the less they're going to make in a lifetime, and the later the stability will come." The drop in enrollment also represents how the pandemic has widened educational racial inequalities. The National Student Clearinghouse reports that enrollment drops at community colleges were largest among Black students and Native Americans.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
Now, let's hear from John Russell. He tells us the latest news about black holes.
A recent study found that the first black hole ever discovered is a lot bigger than scientists first thought. Black holes are extremely massive space objects whose gravity is so powerful not even light escapes. The black hole, Cygnus X-1, was discovered in 1964. It is well known for being the object of a friendly bet between two famous scientists. Researchers found that new observations of Cygnus X-1 showed it is 21 times our sun's mass. That is about 50% more massive than scientists had believed. While it is still one of the closest black holes known, the scientists found it is farther away than earlier estimates suggested. It is 7,200 light-years away. A light-year is the distance light travels in 1 year. Some black holes, like the one at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, are extremely large. These are called supermassive black holes. They can be millions of times more massive than the Sun. Smaller black holes are called stellar mass black holes. They have the mass of a single star. Cygnus X-1 is the Milky Way's largest known stellar mass black hole. It is among the strongest X-ray sources seen from Earth, said James Miller Jones of Curtin University and the International Center for Radio Astronomy Research in Australia. Miller Jones led the study that appeared in the publication Science. Cygnus X-1 turns so quickly that it comes close to the highest rate predicted under physicist Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, Miller Jones added. The black hole brings in material that comes from the surface of the star that it orbits. This star is a blue supergiant, a very large star about 40 times our sun's mass. Cygnus X-1 started to exist 4 to 5 million years ago as a star up to 75 times more massive than the Sun. But then it collapsed into a black hole a few tens of thousands of years ago. The research included data from the Very Long Baseline Array Radio Telescope. It is made up of 10 observation stations in the United States. After Cygnus X-1 was first identified as a possible black hole, a friendly bet was made between two physicists, Stephen Hawking and Kip Thorne. Hawking bet against the object being a black hole, while Thorne bet that it was one. Hawking eventually admitted that the evidence suggested Cygnus X-1 was a black hole. Miller Jones, the leader of the recent study, said, "Indeed, I did not have any wagers riding on these findings." I'm John Russell.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On today's program, we talk about an animal idiom. What do you think it means to be a one-trick pony? Let's start with a pony. That is a small horse. And one definition of a trick is a special act or skill. So pony tricks can be fun to see. But who would want to watch a pony that does the same trick over and over? A one-trick pony is a person that has only one skill. So the term is an insult. A one-trick pony is of low value. A one-trick pony can also describe a person who has had success only once. So, for example, let's say you know a champion weightlifter. He is big and strong and successful in the sport. But it is the only thing he does. He eats, drinks, and sleeps weightlifting. You could truthfully tell him he is a one-trick pony. But be prepared to run away as soon as the words leave your mouth. He probably won't be very happy. Some word experts say the idiom one-trick pony comes from the circus. A circus pony that can only do one trick is not going to entertain a crowd for very long. The term one-trick pony appeared around the turn of the 20th century. Within about 50 years, the term had become an idiom. Note that one trick is usually hyphenated. And if you have more than one, you have one-trick ponies. Now, a one-trick pony usually describes a person, but sometimes it can describe other things, such as a company. If a company only does one thing, such as make ice cream cones, it might be called a one-trick pony. However, that usage is less common. Now, let's hear two friends use the expression in a conversation.
Guess who will perform at my outdoor party next week? Sam, the entertainer.
Please, not Sam the entertainer. He's anything but entertaining.
What do you mean? He has such energy.
He may be energetic, but he's a one-trick pony.
Sam is the best bagpipe player around.
But that's all he does. I hope your guests like loud bagpipe music.
I'm sure they'll love it. I've invited all my Renfest friends.
Now keep in mind that people who specialize in a certain area of their work are not called one-trick ponies. They are specialists. For example, I would never call a doctor specializing in children's illnesses a one-trick pony. She is a specialist and has many skills to do her job. And we here at VOA Learning English specialize in using stories to teach English. But I hope you don't consider us one-trick ponies. And that's all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. History is full of examples of leaders joining together to meet common goals. But rarely have two leaders worked together with as much friendship and cooperation as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill did. Roosevelt was President of the United States. Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain. The two men had much in common. They were both born to wealthy families, and they were both active in politics for many years. Both leaders also shared a love of history and nature and the sea. Roosevelt and Churchill first met when they were lower-level officials during World War I, but neither man remembered much about that meeting. However, as they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other. Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years. They met many times at large international gatherings and in private talks. But the closeness of their friendship might be seen best in a story told by one of Roosevelt's close advisors, Harry Hopkins. Hopkins remembered how Churchill was visiting Roosevelt at the White House one day. Roosevelt went into Churchill's room in the morning to say hello, but the president was shocked to see Churchill coming from the bathroom with no clothes on. Roosevelt immediately apologized to the British leader, but Churchill reportedly answered, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." The United States and Great Britain were the most powerful of the nations that joined together as allies to resist Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Axis partners. In January of 1942, 26 of the Allied nations signed an agreement promising to fight for the goals of peace, religious freedom, human rights, and justice. The three major allies were the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. The governments in Washington and London did not always agree. For example, they disagreed about when to attack Hitler's forces in Western Europe. And Churchill resisted Roosevelt's suggestions that Britain give up some of its colonies. But in general, the friendship between Roosevelt and Churchill and between the United States and Britain led the two nations to cooperate closely. This was not true with the Soviets. The Soviet Union was a communist country. It did not share the same history or political system as the United States or Britain.
And the Soviet Union had its own interests to protect along its borders and in other areas. Relations between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies were mixed. On the one hand, Hitler's invasion deep into the Soviet Union had forced Joseph Stalin and other Soviet leaders to make victory over the Germans their most important goal. On the other hand, shadows of future problems could already be seen. The Soviet Union was making clear its desire to keep political control over Poland, and it was supporting communist fighters in Yugoslavia and Greece. These differences were not discussed much, as the foreign ministers of Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States gathered in Moscow in 1943. Instead, they reached several agreements, including on a plan to establish a new organization called the United Nations. Finally, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met together for the first time. They met in Tehran in late 1943, mainly to discuss the military situation. However, the three leaders also considered political questions such as the future of Germany, Eastern Europe, and East Asia. Later, the Allies made further plans for the new United Nations. They arranged for new international economic organizations, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the Allies agreed to divide Germany into different parts after the war for a temporary period. The Soviet Union would occupy the eastern part, while Britain, France, and the United States would occupy the west. Washington, London, and Moscow were united during the early years of the war because of military need. They knew they must fight together to defeat their common enemy. But this unity faded as Allied troops marched toward the German border. Roosevelt continued to call on the world to wait until the last bullet was fired before deciding what would come next. But Churchill, Stalin, and other leaders already were trying to shape the world that would follow the war. Now differences between the Allies became more serious. The most important question was Poland. Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 had started the war. Roosevelt and Churchill believed strongly that the Polish people should have the right to choose their own leaders after the war. Churchill supported a group of Polish resistance leaders who had an office in London. In 1940, Polish flyers had taken part in the Battle of Britain, piloting British warplanes against the German Luftwaffe. But Stalin had other ideas. He demanded that Poland's border be changed to give more land to the Soviet Union, and he refused to help the Polish resistance leaders in London. Instead, he supported a group of Polish communists and helped them establish a new government in Poland. Churchill visited Stalin late in 1944. The two leaders met with Roosevelt a few months later in Yalta on the Crimean coast. All agreed that free elections should be held quickly in Poland, and they traded ideas about the future of Eastern Europe, China, and other areas of the world. Roosevelt was in good spirits when he reported to Congress after his return from the Yalta Conference.
I come from the Crimea Conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. There were two main purposes in this Crimea Conference. The first was to bring defeat to Germany with the greatest possible speed and the smallest possible loss of Allied men. That purpose is now being carried out in great force. The German army and the German people are feeling the ever-increasing might of our fighting men and of the Allied armies, and every hour gives us added pride in the heroic advance of our troops in Germany, on German soil, toward a meeting with the gallant Red Army. The second purpose was to continue to build the foundation for an international accord that would bring order and security after the chaos of the war, that would give some assurance of lasting peace among nations of the world. That goal, too, in that goal, toward that goal, a tremendous stride was made.
Roosevelt went on to say that the peace cannot be a completely perfect system at first, but it can be a peace based on the idea of freedom. Churchill had the same high hopes. He told the British Parliament after the conference that Stalin and other Soviet leaders wished to live in honorable friendship. "I also know that their word is honest," Churchill said. But as history proved, Roosevelt and Churchill were wrong about the Soviets. In the months after the Yalta Conference, relations between Moscow and the Western democracies grew steadily worse. The Soviet Union moved to seize control of Eastern Europe. Stalin began making strong speeches, charging that Washington and London were holding secret peace negotiations with Germany. And the Soviet Union refused to discuss ways to bring democracy to Poland. Churchill wrote later that he had always held the Russian people in high honor, but their shadow darkened the picture after the war. Britain and America had gone to war not just to defend the smaller countries, but also to fight for individual rights and freedoms. Churchill went on to say that the Soviet Union had other goals. Its hold tightened on Eastern Europe after the Soviet army gained control. And Churchill said that after the long suffering and efforts of World War II, it seemed that half of Europe had just exchanged one dictator for another. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed in secret letters that they must try to oppose the Soviet effort. But before they could act, Roosevelt died. And the world began to live through a new war, the Cold War, in the years to follow. Roosevelt's death, from bleeding in the brain, also ended a deep personal friendship between two world leaders. Winston Churchill later wrote about hearing the news of the death of his close friend. "I felt as if I had been struck with a physical blow," Churchill wrote. He said he was overpowered by a sense of deep and permanent loss. The free world joined Churchill in mourning the loss of so strong a leader as Franklin Roosevelt. But it could not weep for long. War was giving way to peace. A new world was forming. And as we will hear in future programs, it was a world that few people expected.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.